supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb.
Welcome to Voices in the Family. In my role of behavioral health reporter here at the station, I learn a lot about innovative programs, initiatives, and new treatments for mental health that really seem to make a difference in people's lives.
But, Mike, in almost every day, I'm recommending different therapists or different programs to people who call me or email me who are in need of help. And frankly, I find it difficult. I'm often frustrated by the lack of efficient programs, by the fact that what was a good program last year is not a good program this year. And for people who want therapists, it's hard to find a good therapist who takes the right insurance. And common complaints I hear is that the whole system is inefficient. And moreover, people with severe mental illness seem to fall between the cracks.
On today's show, we'll find out what's changing for the better, what's been staying the same, and what could really make a difference. Joining us here in the studio are Dr. Mark Salzer and Edie Mannion. Mark Salzer is a professor and founding chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University, and Edie Mannion is a therapist and manager and co-founder of the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. And later on, we'll hear a pre-taped interview with Dr. Arthur Evans. He heads Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health.
So let's start with one of the most difficult issues in mental health that really begins to gum up the system, and that's stigma. We've learned a lot about mental illness. We've learned that it's mostly a brain disorder, that there's nothing to be ashamed of, and the stigma remains, Mark.
Yeah, first of all, Dan and Mike, and thank you for having me here today. Stigma definitely remains. It's a major issue in the lives of people with psychiatric disabilities, serious mental illnesses, and other mental illnesses. And it's a challenge for family members as well. It affects housing, employment, education, absolutely everything.
Also, give us an example.
Somebody who is applying to a landlord for an apartment in a particular building, the landlord finds out that the person has been diagnosed with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or major recurring depression, that landlord might not rent to that individual. Employer, somebody applies, they find out that they've been hospitalized for the last 2 months, employer might not give the job to the individual. An academic institution, they find out that a college student has a serious mental illness. They're concerned about liability issues and violence. They might be less supportive of that student on a college campus.
We just concluded Mental Health Awareness Month in May, and during that whole month, we hear from all kinds of different people from all walks of life who come forward who say, I've had a mental illness, I dealt with it, I'm living, I'm a productive citizen. Is none of that making a difference, Edie?
No, I think it is making a difference. I think every person who talks openly about their experience makes a difference. I think the language is starting to change. They're getting away from using the term mental illness and talking more about mental health conditions or mental health challenges, and that may scare people less. But yeah, everybody who comes forward, I think, breaks stigma.
There's also an issue of stigma among mental health providers. I was really surprised to read that, maybe naively so.
Right. I actually, first of all, would like to agree with Edie that it's very important for people to be out there, for people to be talking about their experiences, people showing that they are like anybody else, but they happen to also have a mental illness, just like people have diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure, that mental health issues are like everyone else, and actually contact hypothesis. The more contact we have with people who are out there, where folks can see that they're just like everyone else, the better off we'll be. There is also research. Well, first, there's research showing that even though there have been all these public service announcements and initiatives, May Mental Health Month and all these kinds of things, over the last couple of decades, we have not seen a very significant reduction in stigma overall in the general population. So we need to do even more of these kinds of things.
Why? Why? I mean, you know, cancer used to be stigmatized, and we learned about that, and the stigma seemed to go away by and large.
Well, I mean, wouldn't want to completely blame the media, but whereas with cancer, the stories that were being publicized were the real positive things about people with breast cancer, prostate cancer, lung cancer, and it was no longer blaming them for their illnesses, whereas with individuals with serious mental illnesses, we see, you know, crazed lunatic shoots, you know, two innocent bystanders and all this kind of stuff, that even though these individuals represent, you know, an incredibly small minority of people with serious mental illnesses, those are the ones that sell newspapers, get media coverage, really are popular. So that's really counteracting a lot of the positive things that are out there.
I wanted to ask, though, a lot of times the stigma and the shame seems to also affect people who don't have a severe mental illness, even when it comes to suffering an episode of depression or maybe having an anxiety disorder. Even that seems to be affected by the stigma and shame.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Mike. And I mean, my work focuses on people diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression. But at least in terms of stigma, individuals who, you know, just see a psychiatrist for a particular reason, for, you know, maybe depression that isn't as debilitating as it is for other people that I generally work with, mm-hmm. or for anxiety disorders, or even family issues, that mentioning this to other people could get you ostracized.
Mm-hmm. What do you, Edie, do you want to?
I just know that it's incredibly common. I mean, it affects one in five people in this country and one in four families. And what I've heard is that when you do open up, you'll find other people will open up. But the trick is to get up the courage to open up and who to open up to.
I want to come back to a question about therapists who stigmatize. That was interesting to me.
Yeah, I actually am glad you brought it back up again. I wanted to talk about it as well because it's something that those of us who are interested in reducing stigma and also enhancing opportunities for recovery and community integration opportunities for individuals think is another major issue. There have been a couple of studies that have reviewed the literature recently of studies that have been done with mental health providers that has shown that mental health providers have very similar attitudes and beliefs towards people with mental illnesses as the general population.
That's mind-boggling to me. It really is. And you know, Edie, we're going to talk about this in more detail later, but, you know, you talk about quality of care, and all of the research now is talking about what the most effective treatment is, not any particular treatment model. It's all about the relationship. It's all about trust. And if you have that, the prognosis is good. But my God, how can you have that if you know, the therapist is looking down at you? It's not going to work.
Right. And there's some effort being made to get into the four disciplines, psychology and social work, psychiatry, some of the others, to work on this and get the recovery principles and thinking into those schools, because I think the medical model may have gotten away from treating people like equals and sometimes like human beings.
Right.
And I want to invite people to also join the conversation, Dan. Our number here is 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about mental health in some very broad terms, access to care, quality of care. If you've had an experience trying to get care for yourself or a loved one, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499.
And I want to add on that we're having this discussion with Mark Salzer and Edie Mannion. Mark's a professor and founding chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple. Edie Mannion is with the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania.
And I think we should then move on to access to care, which is the number one complaint that I hear about all the time from people. who say they simply cannot find the services that they need. And then when I look around, I see a lot of agencies and care providers who are trying their hardest to have services. So what's with this picture?
Yeah, I mean, we have some great services here in southeastern Pennsylvania, some really unique, you know, we have the basic services and a lot of basic services compared to other counties and other states across the country. We've got terrific stuff out there. It still can be better and there can be more of them, but we're in good shape. It's just that it is difficult to find where it is. I know how to find some of it. I know to go to the office of, you know, County Office of Mental Health. I know that I might call up one particular agency, but each agency doesn't offer the same types of services that other agencies offer, that you really have to be proactive and get out there looking for it. Nobody's making it easy for people to find services.
And when you say being proactive, you're not talking about people who have a bunion. I mean, you're talking about mm-hmm. people who have mental illness, who are suffering, whose thinking might not be clear, and they've got to go through this. It seems to me that our mental health system is really not a system.
Well, I think the President's New Freedom Commission report back in 2003 found that the American mental health system was fragmented and not promoting recovery, and there's been attempts to transform it ever since then. But you're right, Dan. I mean, in my job, I get a lot of calls from family members and friends trying to do the legwork for a loved one who has either had horrible experiences with therapists and programs or just isn't up to the task of finding effective help. So the families are often the ones calling.
So instead of me complaining, what's a family member to do? I've got a mother who's got a son with schizophrenia. Where does she go? What does she do, Edie?
Well, I would say the internet can be a big help with this, but not all people are comfortable with that. So she may have to team up with someone who's comfortable doing internet searches and put in schizophrenia and find out, you know, evidence-based treatments for it, and trying to find that in the local area may involve going to websites that disseminate those treatments. So you narrow it a little bit that way, but then it comes down to that factor that you mentioned, Dan, about the therapeutic alliance. So you can find the right therapy, and it's not done by the right therapist. So then you have to deal with finding the chemistry, finding a person who gets this person and connects with them. And so both of those can take trial and error, and it, like you said, it's very hard to do that when you're in a lot of pain.
The key is, first of all, Edie probably won't promote herself, but I would call Edie Mannion at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. She knows a lot that's out there, and I'm happy for people to contact me as well. But the key is to find what Malcolm Gladwell calls a connector, somebody who really knows all these different types of services and programs out there. Even when you talk to particular providers and different mental health agencies around the county, they might not always know of all the services that are available. And you really need to find these people who know a lot of different things. And unfortunately, they're rare. But I would look in county offices in particular to find these
county offices
of mental health or behavioral health services.
Or the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania.
Definitely try that. Other advocacy organizations, there's the Family Resource Network, mm-hmm. I think. They could be out there and provide some information as well.
And all of these things will be listed on our webpage after mm-hmm. the show.
And I wanted to ask about people with mental illness interact and intersect with a lot of different systems. And when you're affected by a mental health issue, you can maybe be talking to your primary care physician, to this doctor, that doctor. So is anybody talking to each other, Mark?
Well, first of all, I would agree with Edie's comment that historically mental health services have been described as fragmented. The best description I've heard of the mental health system, or lack thereof, is that it's better but not well. It's a better system than it used to be decades ago, when really the focus was on institutions. There's money out in the public mental health system. There's increased attention being paid to the fragmented systems. there have been efforts around the country, and I would say southeastern Pennsylvania in particular, where the mental health system or behavioral health systems are working with criminal justice systems, they're working with the VA, they're working with the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, they're working with the public mental, the public health care agencies. There are more collaborations, more partnerships. It's a great beginning, though. We still have to do even more for them to work together. But I think especially here, we're very fortunate. I mean, we're not great, and I might say that we're a little weller than other places. But, you know, there is some good stuff happening, and family members and individuals who experience mental health issues, you know, they can definitely push us even more.
Has there ever been an effort to centralize the information to create a clearinghouse of sorts?
Well, I know that locally, the Mental Health Association has an information and referral service, and then other programs like mine that also kind of fulfill that function. But that's I think there needs to be more of that. And then we don't want to forget people in the private system who have private health care. How do they find effective help and therapy? Because a lot of times, if you've got some type of more persistent condition, public insurance sometimes opens more doors than private insurance. But on the other hand, you may have access to more licensed mental health professionals.
Yeah, I was wondering about that mother that we created who's got a son with schizophrenia. You talked about, both of you talked about some websites, some ideas about how to begin.
Mm-hmm.
But now who pays? And if she's in a public system, where does she go and what kind of quality is she getting?
Well, I think one great source is support groups. If you go to a support group, for example, the National Alliance on Mental Illness is a big family advocacy organization, and ask around, that can be a big source of word of mouth. Where are the good programs? Where are the bad programs?
What Mark talked about, connectors.
Right.
Do you want to take a phone call, Dave?
Yeah, let's take a call. We've got Lisa on the line. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hello, I have listened to your show a long time. This is my first call-in.
Oh, wonderful. Welcome.
Thank you. Ironically, I'm on my way to therapy. So I want to point out what I was listening, when we were talking about stigma and why people have a difficult time expressing themselves, you know, with their friends, their loved ones. My view and the reason why I don't tell people that I have suffered severe depression and continually am challenged by it, this problem, is because they never seem to know how to communicate back to me. It's very difficult for them because you'll hear things like, oh, I'm sorry, you're gloomy, or I had one friend who I dearly loved tell me once, snap out of it. I mean, they don't have the communication, they don't understand how to communicate to me, and therefore it's just so much easier and yet, ironically, harder for me to just keep it quiet.
Well, let
and
me...
That's what I'm gonna say.
Wait. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, dunk away. So I'm going to put some pressure on you. When you want to communicate to your friends, what is it you want to communicate beyond that level? What is it beyond that label? What is it you want them to know, really?
You know, I think it's that when, and I can only speak for myself as it relates to my depression, I think that I would like them to understand that I'm not always happy. For me, the easiest way to manage my problem is to be quiet about it and to behave in a way that seems socially normal, which is to be happy. And I find that makes it difficult, more difficult for me as I'm trying to overcome a depressive episode.
And what is it you want from them?
Acceptance, understanding, anything but rejection. Does that make sense?
Can I make a suggestion?
Absolutely.
Say that up front about you want to say something to them, and here's what you want, and here's what you fear. Lead with your heart.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Lead with your heart, not your label. Okay?
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. I made that recommendation because that's how I began telling people about my history of depression, and so far, so good with that. Mm. Well, we've got to take a short break. We'll be back in just 1 minute. We're talking about the mental health system. what works, what doesn't work, what needs to be improved. We're talking with Edie Mannion and Mark Salzer. Edie is with the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Mark is a professor and founding chair at the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University. Well, I'm here with Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Teens interested in journalism can use WHYY's production equipment to create news stories based on their interests during the Young Journalist Summer Camp. And for budding young filmmakers, the WHYY Film Academy teaches students to produce their own short films from script to screen. Learn from professionals. Express your ideas. Both camps are for students currently in 9th to 12th grade. Learn more at whyy.org/Hamilton Commons or 215-351-0511.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, and
I'm Mike and Scott. I'm the behavioral health reporter here at WHYY. So Dan and I are doing this show together today. We're talking about very big issues today on the show. We want to talk about the state of mental health care in the United States, what has changed for the better, what are some of the issues that remain when people are seeking care, what kind of quality of care are they getting. And joining us here in the studio are Professor Mark Salzer and Edie Mannion. Salzer is a professor and founding chair of the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences at Temple University, and Edie Mannion is a therapist. She's manager and co-founder of the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. And if you want to join the conversation, if you've had an issue in accessing care, if a loved one is affected by a mental health issue, please call us at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. And I guess the next big issue we want to talk about is quality of care. We've already hit on it a little bit, but you can't be so sure of what you're getting when you're looking for care, Edie, right? That's a big issue that you deal with.
Right, because there's thousands of people calling themselves therapists, and many of them may also have degrees, graduate degrees, multiple degrees, licenses, and still they may not be the right therapist doing the right therapy for you.
So what should, if somebody is affected by an issue, what's the first step? What do you do?
Well, you know, if you can identify, depending on how much pain and desperation you're in, you may not be able to think straight, in which case hopefully you'll have a family member or friend who will help you get help. But it's mainly, I think, seeing this as you're hiring this person. And kind of, if possible, doing a little bit of legwork, like what is it that I'm struggling with? Is it anxiety? Is it depression? Is it post-traumatic stress disorder because I've been through a trauma? What do you think it is? And then trying to maybe go do an internet search on that condition, find out what the evidence-based treatments are, go to those websites and find out who's certified in those treatments. And then, of course, the problem is, do they live in your area and can you afford them? And do they take your insurance? So you can do all that and then run up against a brick wall because it's too expensive or inaccessible.
Edie, I'd like to pick up from there, because another problem is if you find someone who specializes in a certain type of therapy, then their lens might be too narrow and they could just be practicing some technology. Mm-hmm. What I recommend to people is talk to the therapist on the phone at first. And it's not reasonable to expect them to give you 15 minutes, but they'll spend a few minutes with you on the phone. And if they don't, well, that's one piece of data.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And you've got to go in there and talk to them about their track record. What kind of treatment do they do?
Mm-hmm.
And how do they do it? And what can I expect in treatment? What kind of outcome and how long? You can ask all those questions.
Absolutely.
And I think it's important whether you get answers or not, but that'll gauge your comfort level with that therapy.
Absolutely. Then how you feel about them based on that conversation, you may decide yes or no, I want to make an appointment. And then also to sit with them. It may be different when you get there. How does it feel to be with them? And the general rule of thumb is 3 sessions. And if you're not feeling some relief and some sense of hopefulness about change, by then it's time to perhaps move on. A lot of people stay in too long.
Yeah, and not looking for change in 3 sessions, but a sense of connection and hopefulness.
And hopefulness.
Yeah. You know, I've got to say, Dan, though, that there are some disorders, there are some symptoms that people experience where we have very clear evidence that a cognitive behavioral therapy or some interpersonal therapies or other kinds of very specific manualized therapies tend to be more effective for these problems than other things, especially for anxiety disorders, PTSD, included depression. These are things where there are some pretty solid evidence, but there's a whole wide range of other things where there isn't the evidence isn't as good. And then sometimes it might be a poor match with that clinician as well. So they might be using CBT, but like you said earlier, if there's a poor match, poor therapeutic relationship, you don't trust them, you don't like them, you don't think they understand you, that's not going to work for you either.
Or if you feel you're being put in a box, you know, when you're going to...
And Mark, you bring up the issue of evidence-based care, which, as you said, in some areas there is quite a bit of evidence which specific treatment works. What are some areas where we're really not so sure yet what's the best approach?
Boy, that's a great question, Mike. And I keep thinking about all the areas that we do have folks. We do have evidence. You have me stumped on that one. I'm trying to think of specific...
Well, I'm thinking what comes to my mind is the new principles, the guiding principles for recovery are just more like values and sort of attitudes. So they're not necessarily specific manualized treatments, but how do you see your client how do you value peer support? Sharing your own experience with a client when appropriate. Like there's some guiding recovery principles that people who have recovered come back and say, this is what helped me recover.
We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Shelley. Shelley, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Shelley. I have an outpatient mental health center called the Adolescent Connection. I strictly specialize in adolescents. And what I have found, one, is with adolescents, there really isn't a stigmatism around it, because I might run into one of my clients in the mall and they'll, like, run up to me and say to their friends, like, hey, this is my shrink. But I also found that the first step a lot of families have their introduction into therapy is usually through their children. They feel safer saying my child needs help than perhaps I need help. But through that process of helping their child, it can also pull in the family and to get help. But I do believe that you have to be with the right therapist. And I guide families and I say, you know, you need to get them here for the first time, and then it's my job to make sure that they want to return. Well, I also think that therapists should have a good list of other resources to help guide the family to get the right kind of care.
I do agree. I think that is our responsibility. And, you know, I'm a big fan of family involvement. It's my training. That's where my heart is. It can only help. I mean, we're talking about a system here, mental health system. A family is a system like no other.
And I wanted to follow up. Sorry, I stumped you with my previous question, but I wanted to get back to the issue of evidence-based care, because that's such a big topic that keeps coming up. So in the areas where we do have clear evidence that one treatment works better than another, is that being implemented? Is that information getting around? And are people really getting then that specific approach in their treatment?
Right. So first of all, you know, most of my work is in public mental health systems. So I think about it in terms of evidence-based programs.
Right.
And there's a large federal agency called the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, that is in the process of trying to help document these evidence-based practices that exist and put together repositories listing these evidence-based practices. So things like peer support are actually on there as an evidence-based practice, and there are specific activities associated with that. Supported employment, these are special programs to help people with serious mental illnesses go back to work. There are programs to help people go back to school. There's specific forms of case management. Not all case management is an evidence-based practice. There's specific types, one called ACT, which is an evidence-based practice, assertive community treatment. There are dual disorder treatment evidence-based practices. So there are a bunch of them. In terms of implementation, I know Dan's a psychologist as well. We've been talking about this in psychology, how to implement manualized treatments for a couple of decades now, and it's still a challenge, and we have the same issues in the public mental health system as
well. I was just going to say, Mark, in the mid-90s, I was on the advisory board at the Center for Mental Health Services there in Washington. It was the same issue. We're learning lots of stuff. How do we get it in the hands of the practitioners and the administrators?
I've had a thought about that in terms of licensed people have to get continuing education credits. They could mandate taking a certain number of evidence-based intervention courses.
What is that system right now, Edie? I know people in the field have to get continuing education credits.
Right.
What does that mean? That sounds good on paper.
Right. It's an attempt to protect the consumers by making sure that licensed people continue their education. But I think they only require some classes in ethics. But otherwise, you have a pretty wide range of things you can take, not necessarily evidence-based seminars. And yet there are a lot of those out there that people could take. Maybe if the licensing bodies or the insurance companies required more of that. Again, it's not a guarantee just because someone get certified that they're going to be great at it, but it's at least they're exposed to that intervention.
What's your sense in terms of the schools who are teaching future therapists? Are they up to speed on the latest research?
I'm seeing kind of smirks on both our guests' faces.
Don't tell, Dan.
You guys both have to explain that.
Who wants to go first?
Edie, you're closer to the mic to begin with.
Okay. Well, I mean, when we've had students, I've met students, they'll often say, wow, what I'm learning in school, in general, you know, social work school or whatever, is, you know, not what doesn't kind of touch what all that I learn at my internship. And I think I mentioned earlier, SAMHSA is trying to require the training schools to teach more current information. That's hopeful. But, I don't know. I've heard somebody say that changing academia is like moving a graveyard because there's tenured professors who teach basic old classes, and to get that system to change. In Philadelphia here, we have a bachelor's level program that was geared to prepare people to work in the public behavioral health system using the current thinking and technologies. But it's a recent program, so that it kind of had that benefit. It wasn't entrenched.
So, Mark, it's time for you to explain what you were uncomfortable with.
Well, there are a number of things that I'm uncomfortable with. But, changing anybody's behavior is a challenge. So changing current practitioners' knowledge about evidence-based practices is challenging. There is a great initiative happening here in Philadelphia involving Aaron Beck providing cognitive behavior therapy treatment and trying to get that fully ingrained in mental health services here in Philadelphia County, at least, but it comes with challenges. It's those kinds of evidence-based practices weren't necessarily designed for public mental health systems. In terms of what's happening in academic training programs, I'm in academia. Hopefully, I'm far away from the graveyard yet, but it can be challenging for people who were trained in delivering services a while ago. They might not be too familiar with the current practices. For me, at least in some of the disciplines, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy really does have the best evidence that has infiltrated most programs. In terms of psychopharmacology, I would say that, you know, psychiatrists are getting trained in the latest evidence-based practices, but there's still a lot more out there that these disciplines don't know about, that's not in the curriculum, and it's hard to change the curriculum. I know that SAMHSA has this initiative going on. They can develop all they want in terms of new curricula for academic programs to adopt, but it doesn't mean that they'll adopt it unless it's legislated by the national associations.
I want to bring in a caller. Our lines are filled. There's lots of people who want to join the conversation. Let's bring in a caller before our break. We've got Marianne on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Marianne.
My son is has schizophrenia, bipolar, and I found the best thing I did was the family-to-family course run by NAMI. You get to talk to other family members that are in the same situation, and they're a great resource for, you know, treatment and providers in the community.
Well, I appreciate that, and we're going to make sure to get NAMI. That's NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Illness.
National Alliance on Mental Illness.
On Mental Illness on the website. Yeah. I'm sorry for interrupting you, Marianne. Go on.
And then the other thing I found is when I talk to, you know, when I tell friends or coworkers about my son, that it's more than likely they have a family member with the same or similar problems, and it helps a lot to know that you're not the only one in the situation, and that other people have, you know, other families have gone through it and come out the other end.
Yeah, we heard in the beginning, Edie put out a statistic that one in five people have mental illness, one in four families. But when stigma diminishes, hopefully it's when, not if, I think those we're going to see those numbers climb as we learn more. I think it's much more than one in four families, and probably the majority of us have been touched in some way, shape, or other. Marianne, I want to thank you so much for your call, and thanks for adding that resource to our discussion.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a great program. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Marianne.
Mark, I had a quick follow-up to the evidence-based care. It seems to me, coming from the outside, just looking in, sometimes when there is a new treatment, there is more research on it because it's newer and we've done, you know, methodical studies more in recent decades. So an older approach, such as talk therapy, there just aren't a lot of studies, but does that necessarily mean it doesn't work? Just because we have a study that says this works doesn't mean the other thing is not good.
Right, so that's the controversy around advocating or mandating the implementation or full implementation of evidence-based practices only, is that there are a lot of possibly effective practices out there that, you know, funders haven't funded research on, or reviewers haven't liked it, or there might be, you know, certain beliefs about these approaches that people don't want to fund it. So the lack of evidence doesn't mean that something's not effective either.
Right.
And that is a challenge for funders and for us in the field as well.
And we have to make sure we're applying the right therapy to the right person.
Yes.
So that if somebody comes in and you say, I've got the tools, I've got CBT that's going to help you, then, you know, I'm the provider and you're the patient, and that person you're sitting with could already feel disempowered by the culture or by the family, and that's the kind of therapy that could actually do harm. So like anything else, we have to look at the person, and like anything else, we've got to take a short break. We'll be back in 90 seconds. We're talking about the mental health system, what works, what's broken, and how we can access it best. We're talking with Mark Solzer and Edie Mannion. Mark's a professor, founding chair of the Department of Rehab Sciences at Temple University. Edie Mannion is with the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. And make sure to check our website. We're going to have lots of resources up there for you. Well, when we come back, we're going to hear from Arthur Evans, head of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. Well, For Mike and Scott, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and Next to Normal at the Academy of Music. From the director of Rent comes the acclaimed Broadway musical Next to Normal, winner of 3 Tony Awards and the Pulitzer Prize. It is much more than a feel-good musical. It is a feel-everything musical. Next to Normal, starring Alice Ripley in her legendary Tony Award-winning performance, will be at the Academy of Music June 21st through the 26th. For tickets, KimmelCenter.org/Broadway.
Parents, do you feel like you are losing your teenager to drugs and alcohol? If substance abuse is causing changes in your relationship with your child and you don't know where to go, the Family Training Program is conducting a research study that may be able to help. If eligible, you will be invited to individual sessions with a family specialist, which may help you regain control of your family. This study is held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2 or IAmConcerned.org. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
It's commencement season. What awaits this year's crop of college graduates after they receive those coveted diplomas?
My parents sort of have the approach, you go to college, you study what you want, what you love, and your life will just come together, and it'll be magical, and it's not.
Lessons of adulthood in a difficult economy. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott in the studio with Dan Gottlieb today, and we're talking about the mental health system, how it is changing, what's working, what's not working. Here in Philadelphia, things seem to be changing in terms of how services are delivered. Last year, I interviewed Dr. Arthur Evans, who heads the city's Department of Behavioral Health. Philadelphia is moving toward a recovery-oriented system of care, and I spoke with Dr. Evans and asked him what recovery means when we're talking about mental illness.
Well, I think at a real practical level, it means moving beyond symptom reduction to really helping people have a life in the community, a meaningful life in the community, and people really rising to their level, their highest level of potential and functioning.
And what does that mean then for providing services? What kind of services do people need?
Well, if you step back just for a second, I think that it means that it has a lot of implications for how we think about people who are in treatment services and how we deliver services. So if you take people who have mental illness, for example, when I was trained, I'm a clinical psychologist, when I was trained, we were taught that if you had schizophrenia, it was lifelong, that it was a deteriorating condition, that people basically wouldn't get better. And the field really hasn't moved away from that in large measure. But the science today tells us that people do get better. So what that means for the field then is that how do we organize our services so that they have the maximum potential?
What kind of supports do people need in terms of programs that enable them to reach their highest potential?
Well, I think it starts first with how we view people. And I think for many years, and I think it is still true today, we see people through a disability framework. So we look at what's wrong with people. We look at what their problems are. We look at what they can't do. And I think one of the things that is the most exciting about a recovery framework is that we start to look at people through an ability framework. And it is through that framework that we're able to really help people move on to higher levels of functioning to become more integrated in their communities. So I think that it is both how we view people and what are the services that we provide for individuals. And in terms of services that we think help people, for many years we've been very focused on symptom reduction. So if people hear voices, our goal is to help reduce voices. What we're saying from a recovery framework is that we're stopping short of where we ought to as a field, that stopping the symptoms is only one part. The next part is how do we help that person have a fulfilling life? It is, are things like employment help with housing. It is help with developing relationships. Part of our work is how do we help people become reconnected to the broader community.
So does this approach then have to be very much cater toward an individual?
I think it has to be very individualized, and I think one of the implications for a recovery framework is that a one-size approach doesn't work, and that what we have to do is to be very good at understanding what are the strengths that an individual brings, as well as what are the challenges that the person brings. And so, yes, it's a very highly tailored approach.
What does that mean for cost?
Well, I think for cost, it means in some instances it may mean a greater investment on the front end, but all of the data that we have and that when you look nationally shows that on the back end that there are cost savings. Let me give you an example. We were actually able to do this in a cost-neutral way. We have programs that we called partial hospital programs or maintenance programs where people who were formerly in hospitals, state hospitals, came to the community. They came to these programs every day, picked up by a van, brought to the program, and then taken home, literally in that pattern for many years. We changed those programs to a recovery orientation where the staff changed their roles to being coaches, facilitators, helping people to get jobs, helping people to learn how to use public transportation. We did all of that in a cost-neutral way, but what we found is, I'll give you a couple of examples. One is that we reduced crisis visits by 36%. The other is that because we were helping people to use public transportation as opposed to using the Medicaid transportation, we know we've been able to save that system over $1 million in transportation costs. So we know that these approaches, while in some instances they may cost a little more in the beginning, the cost savings on the back end are pretty significant.
And that's Dr. Arthur Evans, who heads Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health. And Mark Zeltzer, a lot of different follow-up questions come out of this. He talked about some fairly simple changes that had big results. And so far on the show, we've talked about very big system changes. But what are some small things that could happen?
Right. So some additional small things that my center has been talking to providers about and systems about include staff, providers, psychiatrists, clinicians, case managers, just talking to people, providing hope, talking about living a meaningful life in the community, that for many people with mental illnesses who I speak with, their recovery really gets set in motion by a provider who simply one day expresses something hopeful about their future.
It sounds like in this recovery movement, we're treating people's lives instead of their symptoms.
Yes.
That's exactly the way to put it. I wouldn't say treating. We're supporting people and living their lives in the community, and we're not. It's not just about symptom reduction and maintenance.
And also the different domains of their lives. You know, their relationships, their work and purpose part of their life, their housing situations. So many, all the domains.
So it could be a 30-second interaction where, while a psychiatrist are very busy, their interactions are 15 minutes, sometimes less. They've got to cover a lot very quickly. But 30 seconds of that while they're typing something up or writing a script, say, hey, have you thought about work lately? Have you thought about dating lately? Have you thought about going back to school? I can't talk to you more about that now, but if you're interested, just let somebody know and we'll try to find something for you. Promoting shared decision-making and self-direction, these are evidence-based practices that are getting more evidence behind them. It's a different way of interacting with patients, with people who are coming for services, where they're more engaged, and that enhances service engagement, hopefully decreases non-adherence. People are fully engaged. And that's better for the system, better for them, better for families.
I have spoken over the years with many, many people who have overcome extreme diversity. And, you know, their stories are different. Even their stories of how they recovered are different. But they all seem to have one thing in common. Almost all of them tell me there was somebody who believed in me just at the moment I needed it in my life.
Absolutely.
And we don't have a lot of time left, unfortunately, but another thing that Dr. Evans hit on here is he was able to track some of the outcomes in the changes that he made in terms of how people's lives were affected and in terms of cost. Now, there's a lot of billions of dollars are being spent on the federal and state level on mental health care. How are we tracking the outcomes? Is it even possible to trace whether there's change or not?
Well, it's really complicated to track service reduction. I think Dr. Evans is probably talking more about some cost shifting. So we invest certain efforts in one area, we can reduce the number of SEPTA passes or something like that. So there's a way that you can see some savings in that way. But it's very challenging to document outcomes at a systems level. It's challenging enough to track outcomes at an individual patient or person level as well. But there are some initiatives out there. People are trying to be more data-driven. I know Dr. Evans and some of the surrounding counties are trying to be more data-driven about what they do. They're trying to look at cost savings efforts. But it is incredibly complicated.
I'd like to ask, Edie, I'll start with you. I'd like to ask you both the same question. Your vision for the future, not what you dream of, but where you see us in 5 years, 10 years.
Oh, so not what we dream of. Well, I think if it keeps moving forward, I think the more that advocates push the system, push their legislators, push the insurance companies, and speak out about what they want and what they don't want, that will make things speed up in terms of improvement.
Mark?
And I guess what I dream of or I'm excited about is this is a very innovative mental health community we have in southeastern Pennsylvania, New Jersey as well, some very innovative things. So I'm hopeful that Delaware County and Chester and Montgomery, who have done great things, continue to innovate, as well as Philadelphia County, continue to innovate, continue to be leaders. I think services are getting better, will continue to get better. We've got a way to go. We can be even weller than we are now.
Are these different counties communicating with one another about what works?
They absolutely do, and they've been in more communication over the last couple of years. They're understanding that this is requires a regional effort, so the leading administrators are really talking with one another, and it's very exciting. And again, this doesn't happen all over the country.
So you're a good therapist, Mark, because we're leaving the show and I'm feeling hopeful. So you've cured me.
Thanks, Dave.
I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been really a rich and important show. And Mike, and you too. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan.
My guests have been Mark Salzer and Edie Mannion. Mark's a professor, founding chair of the Department of Rehab Sciences at Temple University. Edie is with the Training and Education Center at the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Earlier in the show, we heard from Arthur Evans, Jr. He's head of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability. Well, this Friday, I'll be giving a talk about healing from within at the Integrative Medicine and Wellness Conference at Penn's Abramson Cancer Center. You can find out more about it by looking at penncancer.org. Admission is free. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Our interns are Emily Haas and Evan Pliz. Mike and Scott is our executive producer and my co-host today. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.